Delightful.
I'm so glad that you agreed to talk to me. It's exciting.
Oh, no problem. I have some great memories of the red herring. Oh, man.
Yeah, well, before we get into it, I just want to make sure, like, just for, your name is spelled Brenda and then Thompson, right?
Okay. I like to use my middle initial too, J.
Okay.
I try to honor my mom. That was her name, so Juanita.
Okay, yeah. It's good to know. Where was your mom from?
Las Vegas.
Okay.
Back when it was a little town.
Okay. Because you don't meet, I'm from Peru, and I don't really meet anyone called Juanita up here. So I was like,
Peru, right? How exotic! Yeah, when I was in Cuba, they'd read my middle name. This is in 1992. They'd read my middle name and like go, and they'd start talking to me in Spanish. And nope, can't do it. Sorry. There was a country western song named Juanita that was popular about the time my mom was born.
Okay.
So you'll find Juanita's in that age bracket.
I see.
Yeah.
So what was your, like, how did you get involved with red herring?
Well, I was quite an activist at the time, and I was also going to Mount St. Vincent. And this is pre-internet days, 1987. Okay. Whew, that was a while ago. You probably weren't even born yet.
No.
With my activist friends, they, you know, I'm looking for research and stuff like that, so they told me about this fabulous store to go to. And so I went, and I just thought, there's all sorts of stuff here I can't get anywhere else. And then I heard that they were looking for volunteers, so I signed up. I was a single mom at the time, too, so I just brought my kid in with me.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, she was like 7 or 8, so she was okay.
And had you been, because it was like a co-op store, right?
Yep.
Had you had, like, experience in that kind of a store before?
Not in a co-op store. I lived in co-op housing at the time, but okay. I'd never had that kind of experience with a co-op store.
And how old were you when you first started volunteering there?
27.
Okay. Did your daughter like it there?
Oh, yeah. She loved it. I ended up buying this poster there. It was blood red with black letters, "Fuck authority." She loved it. I think she still has it. She's 41 now.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What other posters did they have?
Oh, they had all sorts of posters that were, you know, revolutionary stuff from, you know, China, Soviet Union at the time, you know, that's the kind of posters they had. And then some old movie-style posters from the 30s and 40s, you know, James Dean with a cigarette and all that.
Ah, classic. Yeah, my partner has so many James Dean pictures. I'm, like, looking at a picture of James Dean right now, actually.
I wonder if his ears are ringing.
Did you get any, what was your favorite book that you got there? Because you were saying there's a lot of stuff you couldn't find in other places. Was there something, a title that you remember particularly?
Oh, boy. I think I bought a book just before I left Halifax. That was in 1993. And it was Domestic Violence in Every Culture. But I can't remember the name of it, so.
Okay.
I remember it had a red cover. I remember it had a picture of women in burqas. And I was off to a job in Yarmouth running the shelter for abused women. And so I knew about, you know, the white culture, but I wanted to know more about other cultures and how they would react or what expectations they would have, and, you know, as I took on this job.
Right. Where did you say the job was?
Yarmouth.
Oh, okay.
It was pretty white back then.
But just in case, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Just in case.
So if you started volunteering in 87, did you get to see all the locations or just, because I think there was three, right?
Yeah, I was just in the one by, down by the Maritime Mall. It's now a parkade. I was so sad to see that go.
What did it look like?
Well, it was an old building, which I love old buildings, and the floors all creaked when you walked on them. They had carpet down, but, you know, the floors all creaked and were kind of spongy in places. The poster room was separate from the books. And there was one room for books that were all LGBT. Mm-hmm. Actually, back then we called it GBLT. And then there was a room just for posters and DVDs and things like that. And then the main room was all books with stacks in them. And the cash register counter was kind of tucked in the corner. And then they had this big bulletin board. You could put your posters up for whatever anarchist thing you were doing or what films were coming up at Wormwood and things like that. It was just such a great spot.
Were they wooden shelves or did they slide around? Like, how did that work?
I recall metal shelves.
Okay.
But everything else was wood.
And was it new books or secondhand books?
New books. All new books. There was a box of secondhand books, but that was in the porch area when you walked in. And you could go through the secondhand books.
Okay. And, I'm asking because I'm trying to imagine the smell, because I work...
wonderful!
Yeah?
I love the smell of new books. I'm a spine sniffer. When I wrote my books, when they, you know, they come to you in a box, and, mm-hmm. Oh my God, my book, and the first thing I do, every new book I write, I open it up and I sniff the spine. I just love that smell.
I work in a bookstore right now, and I think we carry one of your books, Enslavers of the Maritimes.
Yeah, yep, that's mine. Yeah, I got into a bit of a battle with your manager there. This was a couple of years ago, so he might have changed, but he just wasn't paying the bill.
Oh.
Or, yeah.
Is this Mike or Dan?
I can't remember, but, okay. You know, it was well over a year, and he still hadn't paid the bill. So.
Wow. But did that get sorted? Because, I mean...
That happens a lot, actually, with small independent bookstores that don't pay the bills, so...
Wow.
You know, they wait till they sell them and then pay, maybe.
Right.
And that's just not good for publishers, so... Anyway.
You had a book, I don't remember the title, Survival Guide for Single Mothers, maybe?
Yes, that was my first one. Oh, yeah. Again, before you were born.
Right.
88, I believe it was. And that was just for Halifax, but it was so popular that it expanded it to Nova Scotia. And that was 1990 was the first one that came out.
Did that ever sell at Red Herring?
No, it was a giveaway book. So they would have stacks of it because... The first Xerox bound book, that was printed by Status of Women's office for me, and they bound it all for me, and I'd give it away. The second one for Nova Scotia, it was called DALPERG then, Public Interest Research Group, I know you know about it, and that was Anna Marie Larson, who lives just down the road from me now, she arranged that we could do perfect binding if I expanded it all to Nova Scotia, which I did. And they were still giveaways. So yeah, the Red Herring had a stack of books there, and, you know, your single mom, single dad, whatever, you come down. Single dads were not so numerous then. Mm-hmm. Just come and get a book.
Were there other books that were, like, giveaway books? Is that a regular thing?
No, that was just my book.
Okay.
Because that was the way I wanted it. Low-income single moms can't afford to buy a book.
Yeah. That's true. And what was the first, the place that printed the first edition?
Status of Women.
Status of Women?
Yep.
Okay.
I think it's gone now. I think one of the governments did away with it, so.
What other... Sorry, you go.
It was a provincial department.
Okay. Yeah, they like doing away with those.
Yeah, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I won't get started on that, but where else did you guys get books from?
Well, I would go to the regulars, like Kohl's bookstore. To do research, I was either, I was in Dalhousie Library, St. Mary's, Mount St. Vincent. I was always in and out of their libraries, but to get a book I could physically have, I'd go to the Red Herring. Oh, the other place I would go, I had a friend of mine who was going to Harvard, so I would go down to visit him with my daughter. And, oh my gosh, the bookstores they had down there, oh, they were wonderful. They reminded me a lot of Red Herring, because there were books there you couldn't get anywhere else.
Right. And where Red Herring, like, what were their suppliers?
I'm not sure who their suppliers were, but I do know that, the co-op picked up which books they wanted to, the board members or whatever wanted to pick out what books they thought would be good, and so they brought them in small orders at a time, and the books were regularly stolen there, too, so.
The what?
Books. They were regularly stolen at Red Herring.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which is, a shame, because... Don't do that, but I know you really want the information, but don't do that.
Yeah, it's hard to be mad about someone stealing a book, right? Because it's like, okay,
yeah,
I get it, but...
Bring it back when you're done!
What was your role as a volunteer? Like, what was that like?
I just staffed at the store.
Okay.
For an afternoon or a day or something like that.
And was it mostly, your friends who came in, or what kind of people?
Oh, lots of people I'd never met before. Lots and lots of people.
Does anyone stand out in your memory?
No, not particularly.
Okay. And what did, I know you kind of answered this earlier, but I, I want to ask again. Yeah, what did it feel like the first time you went in and you could find all these books that you couldn't find otherwise?
Yes, so exciting. I mean, books on, I'm a single mom on welfare at the time. Mm-hmm. So there were studies done there, books that were studies of single moms, low-income single moms. There were, and I had friends who were single moms, but who were lesbian, and there were books on that too. Like, I'd just never seen this stuff. Our libraries did not carry that kind of stuff, like our public libraries. And, because when I became a single mom, I wasn't a teenager, I was 21. But the only thing on single moms in the public libraries was about teenage single moms and what a problem they were. That was it. So to find a book that was positive about single mothers, wow. that made my hair stand on end.
I can only imagine. When I lived in Peru, it was really hard to find, books about, being queer or anything like that. And so when I would find one, it would be like...
Wow, gold!
Yeah. It kind of makes me feel more real, almost. I don't know.
Well, and it's kind of a validation that you're not the only one who exists. There are others. Wish you could find them.
Yeah.
Like I said, we pre-internet days.
That's a good point. Yeah, because of that, the bulletin board must have been really important as well.
It was. It was very important. People stopped in just to read the bulletin board, what's going on. They'd, stop in once a week or something. What's going on?
Wow.
Where is it going on? Oh, yeah.
Because they had...
They'd ask me questions about, about this event, and if I did know something, I'd tell them. If I don't, I could often find, where to find out about this event.
Did you,
Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say the Black Market Boutique started about that time, too. So
really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Black Market's been there forever.
I didn't know. Were they close by? Because they've moved around a lot lately.
Yeah, they were in the place. Well, see, I haven't been in there in a couple of years now. So Red Herring was down, I can't even remember the name of the streets, by the Maritime Mall, and the Black Market was up on Pizza Corner.
Right. Yeah, they only just recently moved out of there, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I always liked that space.
Yeah. I wonder if I can find the name of the street for you. I should have it written down. Was it Granville Street?
I don't know. Let me take a look. Because I'll recognize it as soon as I see it. Oh, come on, phone.
Apparently there was Barrington, Argyle, and Granville.
Argyle? No. Was it Argyle? Okay. Just let me get a map of Halifax. Just a minute.
Yeah, no rush.
Sorry, baby. I got a puppy in my arms.
Aw. Lucky you.
Maritime Center, they call it now, okay. And it was on Hollis Street.
Oh, okay.
Wait a minute, no. Granville, you're right, it was Granville.
Okay.
Yep.
They're right next to each other, I think. Well, are they?
Well, you go off Barrington, turn down Salter or Blowers, and you can get to Red Herring.
So yeah. Like real south end.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Yeah, and the Black Market was up on Market Street.
Okay.
If I recall that correctly. So, nope, sorry. That was on Grafton, now that I'm looking at the map.
What kind of events do you remember going? Because there was some that would happen at the Red Herring, right?
Yep. I didn't really go to their events because, you know, it was mostly adults and I had a small child, so.
Right.
I just kind of stayed away because I just didn't have the time or it wasn't appropriate for her or whatever. Mm-hmm. And by appropriate, I mean it was late. She knew all about gay people because I had so many of them over, and that was pretty rebellious for 1987.
And did your daughter find any books at the Red Herring?
Yep, there was one book in particular. I Have Two Moms. She loved that one.
But she didn't have two moms.
Nope.
She just liked it.
Yeah, she just liked it. It was an interracial lesbian couple, and they had a daughter together. And so the daughter wrote, you know, it was a children's book called I Have Two Moms, mm-hmm. and why it was so great to have two moms.
So there were children's books, too, then?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Yep.
I didn't know that. That's.
Oh, wow. No, there were children's books there, too. I mean, not a great selection, but
right.
They were there.
Was it when you would staff, like, the till, was it always, like, only one volunteer in at a time, or
yeah.
a few?
Okay. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And did you get to be friends with other people there?
Well, ironically, when I was in high school, I had a bully. His name was Ned. He bullied me constantly about my looks, about how I did my hair. Anyway, I'm in there working with my daughter one day, and he comes in, and it turns out part of the reason why he was so nasty was because he was gay. But you couldn't come out in those days. And by 1987, they were starting to, you know, you can come out. It wasn't such a shame or shock. Anyway, he and I ended up being friends.
Oh.
Yeah, because when he came in, he was shocked to see me. I was shocked to see him. With his dyed hair and his earrings and everything. This is my bully. And he apologized to me for all the things he did. And anyway, he did end up dying of AIDS, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was that, like, in
the early 90s.
In the 90s, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. at first we're a little wary around each other.
Of course,
and then he, and then he said, I'm going to have to apologize to you. He said, I've thought about you a lot since we got out of high school and all the things I said and did to you. And I just looked at him and went, oh, my God, you're gay. He goes, didn't you know that? No, I had no idea. He said, well, I didn't let anybody know until after high school anyway, so... Yeah,
and did he come in like to buy a book or just?
Yeah, he was coming in to look in the LGBT section.
Right. And yeah, what about your coworkers? Were they? Did you get to know them well?
No, not really. I mean, I already knew them outside of the store, so we didn't see each other a lot in the store.
Okay.
Like, yeah, we're just passing.
Do you remember who they were?
One was Michelle Case, and I haven't heard of her in, like, 40 years.
Michelle Case? Like
Michelle Case, yep. Her dad was from Colombia. No, Guyana. Because he was involved with that whole Jim Jones thing. He was an official in Guyana and had to deal with that. So that's why I remember Guyana. And her mom was white Canadian. So, but she worked there, too. But
okay.
I don't know where she is. I've not a clue.
Wait, like the cult? Sorry, that just took me a second.
Yeah, the Jim Jones cult. Yeah, her father had to deal with that.
Oh, wow.
That was 1978, I think it was. I remember her telling me about her dad having to deal with that. The fallout, the bodies, and all that stuff. Do you know, have you ever heard of the Jim Jones cult?
Like, briefly. I don't know about it in detail, though.
Have you heard the expression, well, he drank the Kool-Aid?
Yes.
Well, that's where it comes from.
Oh, okay.
Because Jim Jones had them all drink Kool-Aid spiked with arsenic.
Okay.
Yeah. There's quite a few documentaries out there about it. If you want to be appalled, I highly recommend.
Okay. who else was working at the store? This is fascinating.
Well, I can't remember. It's been so long ago. But, like I said, I just remember having a lot of fun talking to interesting people. You find out all the stuff that was going on in the alternative community of Halifax,
mm-hmm.
which is where I wanted to be because I didn't fit in with the married 2.5 kids, work 9 to 5. I just didn't fit in with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be with the alternative community, and that was the hub. Red herring. You could find so much going on. That, and I'd go to the gay clubs. The Turret. I would go to that one, too, to find out what else is going on. Who's where? Who's with who? Loved my gossip.
because you were, like, already kind of not super conventional in your thinking before you got to Red Herring, right?
That's right. Oh, yeah.
So how did that, like, how did that change things for you to, you know, meet more people?
Well, I found my tribe. I found my people, you know, and I may not be gay, but they think, a lot of them think the same way I do,
mm-hmm.
In terms of, I don't want to work 9 to 5. I don't want the white picket fence. I don't want the mortgage and the car loan. I don't want any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I want a freer life. I want to travel. I want to, you know, raise my kid my way and all that stuff. And I had never run into anybody like that before in my upbringing because my parents, well, my mom is Baptist. That's my nickname for her. All right, come on, Baptist, let's go. But she was brought up Baptist, but she's, you know, when she became an adult, she became non-religious.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was from Quebec, an Anglophone from Quebec. And they did everything expected of them, and I watched how hard they worked and how hard it was to get ahead, and they never really did get ahead. Something would always happen, and I just thought, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, to meet, and I always thought it was weird. And I was irresponsible and all this stuff, and so when I met up with older people than me who were hanging out at the Red Herring or coming in to check the bulletin board and stuff, I was just in heaven. These were my kind of people. They thought like me. I still think that way, by the way.
I mean, that's definitely also how I feel, you know, getting to... You're the first person I'm interviewing about Red Herring.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel similarly, where it's like... Because, you know, my parents and my friends' parents are all like you're describing, like trying to do the right thing. And so it's wow.
Yeah. It's just like, I had an epiphany one day when I was in my 20s and thought, there is no reward at the end of this all. There's no trophy. There's no diploma that you can frame, you know, that says, Brenda followed the rules. Congratulations. And that's when I thought, well, what am I doing this for? I mean, I did try to fit in several, you know, earlier in my life. And then I tried to, you know, again, when I finished university and I went out to, you know, start my career, I tried fitting in, but I just couldn't do it. It's just not me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's not a lot of people, but they do it anyway. And I think, what a shame.
So was it kind of like on a social level, a similar thing to, you know, finding a book about yourself, kind of finding people who think the same way? Did it feel similarly, like, connecting? Or
very much like that. Very much like that. You know, shocking mm-hmm. and delightful.
And, so how did the rest of your life, how was the rest of your life influenced by meeting, people with similar, who thought similarly?
Well, I finished, I very reluctantly finished up university with a master's degree and got a job down in Yarmouth running a shelter for abused women and their children. And of course, I went there thinking that the women who worked there would think similar to I do, but they were all grandparented in, so they didn't have the background, the philosophy, the education, and we just clashed. 3.5 years I lasted there. I mean, they were, you know, they still believed in heterosexual marriage, work 9 to 5, white picket fence. They all believed in that, and because that's the way they were raised, and they never had the privilege or opportunity to get an education like I did. And so we had a hard time meeting eye to eye because I'm coming there with all these radical ideas, and they're very much, I'm a housewife who got a part-time job as a bookkeeper, and now I'm working here at Juniper House.
Right. So it was mostly the staff who you clashed with, or also, like, the clients?
Yeah. I didn't clash at all with the clients, no.
Okay.
But I clashed with the staff because they just, and like I said, Yarmouth was very white at the time. Black people were around, but they kept out of town.
Right.
And if there were any gay and lesbian couples around, like, I think Diane Cole was the biggest dyke of all, and she made no bones about it. But she was about the only one I knew down there that was, you know, thought like me. Was it? So I tried to fit in there for the career, gave up in 96, and then I moved up here to Annapolis Royal. I was just going to stay here for the summer. And then I was going to go out west with all my friends, because they were all out there in BC. But then I discovered what a little gem this place is. It's full of writers and historians and artists and philosophers. I mean, we have Order of Canada recipients here. We got a two Nobel Peace Prize winners here. Yes, it's quite a little town. We have, per capita, we have the most gay-owned businesses in the Maritimes, in Annapolis Royal, yeah. So, I found my tribe again. And it took a little while to dig some out.
Right.
You know, I started off working at King's Theatre as a house manager, and that helped me to find them. And now, you know, I've got quite a posse of them now, and I'll be here 30 years soon.
Right, yeah, next year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was going to, like I said, just for the summer, and I never left. Oh, sorry, I did leave briefly. I had a boyfriend, and I made one of the stupidest mistakes of my life. I followed him to Mexico, because he was in the textile business. He was English.
Okay.
And I got down there, and he just turned into this white colonial pig down there, and so he got a Dear John letter, and I came back to Annapolis Royal.
Nice. Yeah, it is shocking how there's definitely some big culture shock the further you go south, like how white people act.
I know. I know. I mean, we go to Jamaica pretty regularly, mm-hmm. and we were in this one spot outside of Negril. It's where a lot of the workers for the resorts and hotels live, mm-hmm. and we had a friend of ours, a Jamaican, who was taking us through because we had organized to buy school uniforms for kids down there because kids can't go to school unless they have a uniform and shoes.
Yeah.
And so we were in, it's called Red Ground, and we were there, and man, we were getting some hateful, dirty looks. And I understood it immediately. I mean, they deal with ignorant white people all day.
Yeah.
They don't want to come home and see one in their neighborhood. I get it.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, white people snapping their finger. Oh, we went into this one place once, and I just refused to sit down because it's all white people sitting and all black people serving, and I just, no, not going here.
Yeah. And then people are always, like, deeply, I think the worst part is how deeply surprised people are when you're, like, decent.
Yeah, exactly. They expect the worst from us, and I get it.
Yeah.
I totally get it, so. Anyway, but we had quite a successful organization for a while, buying uniforms for kids every year, so.
Wow.
Yeah, but the guy who organized it all, he caught cancer, and he's just now getting over it. It's been 5 years, so. Mm-hmm.
Who was the guy who was organizing that?
What do you call it? CanJam, Canadian Jamaican. He lives in Paradise up here, and he's just getting over stomach cancer.
Oh, wow.
It was successful for him. He's in his 70s now, so.
That's sweet. Can I ask his name? Or?
Yeah, it's Ross McLaughlin. My husband should be there right now, as a matter of fact. The only reason we got married because I also had a bout with cancer, and I thought, you know, if I was going for life-saving surgery, and I said to my boyfriend, well, why don't we get married? It's a whole lot easier for you to make decisions
right.
regarding me if we are legally married. And he said, sure, let's do it. So 3 weeks later, we got married. Really romantic.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the peak of romance.
But, hey, it's been 16 years, so I guess we stuck with it.
Yeah.
Well, we've been married 13 years, pardon me. We were together 3 years before that, so.
I have a couple more red herring-related questions, if
that's
okay. Sure. So, when did you leave when they closed, or before that?
I left before that because I moved to Yarmouth.
Okay.
Yeah, to run Juniper House.
And was it a big deal for you to leave, or?
Oh, yeah, it was huge. I didn't want to. I was going to go down there for a year and then come back again. But I got waylaid by Annapolis Royal.
Right. Do you remember what it was like to say bye to all your friends there?
Oh, yeah, it was heartbreaking. But I also try to assuage my feelings by saying, I'm coming back in a year. I'm coming back in a year. It's only 3 hours down the road.
Right.
But I didn't. And they all moved on too. You know, some went to Toronto, some went to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember coming back for a weekend, and Red Herring had moved up onto Argyle Street.
Right.
And I went in, and I just thought, this just doesn't have the same feeling.
Huh.
And, I mean, I looked at the books. Yep, there's still great books here, but it just didn't have... I just loved that old little creaky store.
Were there posters on the walls in the old store on Argyle?
Yep.
I'm sorry, on Granville?
Granville, yep, yeah. There were.
I mean, what posters were there?
Mostly, you know, revolutionary ones.
Right.
And this was before the fall of the Berlin Wall, so, you know, there was a lot of, like, posters about East Germany, about the Soviet Union, about the revolutions fought in various places, like Latin America, lots of posters about Latin America because Pinochet. There was a lot going on with Pinochet at the time, mm-hmm. and El Salvador, Guatemala. Oh, there's just
So it was a lot of like contemporary posters.
Yep. And oh no, not so much T-shirts. Occasionally they'd have T-shirts, but not. It wasn't one of their main things.
And do you know who is making all these posters about, like, current events?
I think they were buying them and putting them in the store, whoever, you know, the co-op board, yeah.
Right.
But, like, there would be Women Unite, Take Back the Night T-shirts and stuff, all in purple.
Okay.
Stuff like that, you know, but for the occasion when, you know, they knew that the Women's March was going to happen, they'd stock them with some T-shirts, and those were locally made.
Okay. Is there any specific person that was, like, hard to say bye to when you left?
Gosh. I haven't seen him since. No, wait a minute. I saw him once when I was up in Toronto. He was head of the Communist Party, Manuel. He was from Peru as well.
Yeah.
What is his name? It's not coming to me. Anyway, he left Halifax to go to Toronto to head up the Communist Party of Canada. And I know as soon as I hang up, his name's going to come to me. But, you know, this is 62. This is what you got forward. Look forward. Anyway, if you Google him, he'll come up. Figueroa.
Okay.
Manuel Figueroa. Yeah, his dad was Peruvian. And he said he grew up with a whole lot of anti-Americanism.
Yeah. And what was your farewell like with him? Was it just
He came over to my apartment when I had everything all packed up.
Okay.
I met him through people who came into the Red Herring, and he was never a boyfriend or anything like that.
Right.
He was just a really interesting person to talk to.
And did he also do Red Herring stuff or not?
No. Okay. He would drop in, pick up books or whatever.
Right.
Or drop off the, what was it? I can't remember the name of the communist newspaper at the time. Anyway, he would drop those off. Those were free as well.
That sounds
good. The workers, workers something. Anyway. And at that time, too, I was pretty notorious. So a lot of people recognized me.
Okay.
So he recognized me, too. This is an offside, but it kind of explains why I made so many people and went down that route. When I was a single mom on welfare, it was a two-tiered welfare system at the time. You had municipal social assistance and then provincial social assistance. I was on municipal social assistance, and for a single mom to move to the provincial social assistance, which gave you more money, you had to sue the father of your child for child support. Well, there was two reasons I didn't want to do that. A, because there was no such thing as maintenance enforcement in those days, and I didn't want him involved in our lives.
Right.
But we got to the point where I had to sign an affidavit and name him, so I did. And we had the test done. We had the first tissue typing test done in Nova Scotia. It was kind of a precursor to DNA.
Okay.
And it said that the man I named wasn't the father. So I said, oh, okay, well, whatever. So they gave me another affidavit and said, name the real father this time. So I named the same man because I said, your tests are wrong.
Right.
And so then I wrote this opinion piece for the Daily News with the encouragement of my friend Tom Regan, who is the nephew of Gerald Regan, who used to be the premier of Nova Scotia. Anyway, so I wrote an opinion piece about what it was like to live on social assistance, on municipal social assistance, and I really pissed off the minister of social assistance, Edmund Morris. And so he took my social assistance file. He referred to NDP ghostwriters in the press, in the legislature. late one night. So the press are all in their room going, who's he talking about? So when he stepped outside the legislative room, the press said, who are you talking about, NDP ghostwriters in the press? Well, he referred specifically, Edmund Morris did, to my article about what it's like to live on social assistance in Nova Scotia. And he called me an NDP ghostwriter, and then he told the press that I had twice named the wrong man as the father of my child, and that's why I couldn't move from municipal assistance to provincial assistance. Mm-hmm. Big stink in the newspapers and in the national news, and because I took him to court over it. I said he had no right to reveal that information as the minister of confidential information, you know, of social assistance. That's confidential information. You have no right to reveal that. So I took him to court, and amazingly, I won. Mind you, the judge was he called me. He said what I wrote in that article was possibly slanderous, and I'm thinking, slanderous? You're a judge. You know the difference between slander and libel. But, it was a maximum fine, $2,000, and 6 months in jail. A minimum fine was $200. Well, the judge found that Mr. Morris was such a lovely character, and I was nothing but a welfare mother, so he only fined him $100.
What?
Yeah. Oh, those were the days.
Wow.
And it was, you know, I didn't care if he fined him $10. The point was, he found Morris guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been on W5, National News, all those kind of things by then. And so a lot of people recognize me. So when I'm working in the red herring, people come in and go, oh, my God, it's you. Yep, here I am. So that's just an aside to why people, you know, when I'm doing work there, you know, or I'm doing my volunteer work, people would recognize me. But I couldn't get a job after what Edmund Morris did to me and all that stuff. There was just no way. So I thought, why not go back to school? And I talked to this one single mom when I was at a women's convention, a convention for women, and it was in the old Bloomfield School. And I said, well, she asked me what I planned for my future. I said, well, you know, I thought about going to university, but yeah, I've got a kid. It's kind of difficult. She said, well, I didn't let that stop me. And I said, oh, how many kids have you got expecting to hear two?
Mm-hmm.
She said, six.
Oh, wow.
So I was on the bus that afternoon. I went out to Mount St. Vincent and got an application to go to university. And the rest, as they say, is history. And I had the time of my life. I loved university. You know, learning about things alternative to 9 to 5, white picket fence, heterosexual marriages, 2.5 kids.
And I mean, how were you making, like, ends meet for your, you know, your daughter and yourself while studying?
Student loans.
Okay.
And my parents.
Okay.
I always called it, you know, mom's grocery store.
Yes.
A lot of people are familiar with that one.
So you said you were trying to get, like, before you volunteered at Red Herring, you were trying to get a job, but it was, like, difficult because of the...
Well, daycare was unaffordable.
Yeah.
There wasn't any subsidized daycare then. And the jobs didn't pay enough for me to pay daycare. I also wasn't getting any child support.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of stuck on social assistance, at least until she went to school. But even then, you know, they get out at 2. What job do you know is going to, you know, work 8:30 to 2 o'clock? No jobs.
Yeah.
So, and they didn't pressure you in those days to go get a job. They said, be home with your kid. But then a new government came in, and that was that. And you had to, they decided they were going to start pushing you off social assistance after a year after you had the baby. But there still wasn't the resources and the supports for women to go back to work, to miserable, low-paying, crappy jobs, even if they wanted to.
So did that contribute to you leaving Halifax, or?
It did. Well, and like I said, my daughter was older by then.
Mm-hmm.
She was 9, and we went down to Yarmouth, and Juniper Host was right across from her elementary school. So after school, she just came over to Juniper Host and sat in my office. That's how I could take care of that.
Okay. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have asked you?
I don't know. I'm just pouring out my life story to you. If you think of anything else you want to ask, or I think of anything, we can just email each other.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, because, you know, things always pop up in your head later, and, you know, why didn't I ask, or why didn't I say, or whatever. So.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so, no, it's been interesting questions about a subject I hadn't thought about in ages.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this.
Oh, thank you for asking. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I told you, like, I'm writing for a woman named Jess Wilton, and she's doing her PhD on queer history in the Maritimes.
Yep.
Yeah, and she's, like, looking for people to research different things that she was interested in, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff. And so I was like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. So
right on.
Yeah, you're my first interview, so I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. I'm kind of flattered. I'm your first one. All
yeah.
right, well, you have a nice, cool afternoon.
You too, yeah.
I'm right in front of the heat pump. I got the AC on.
Okay, good,
life is luxury. With a puppy on my lap.
Well, I hope you rest of your afternoon is nice and cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Like I said, don't hesitate to email anything else.
I appreciate it a lot. Thanks,
Brenda. Okay, Antonia. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.